Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Neal Stephenson, whose latest book is Reamed. Earlier novels include Snow Crash, Cryptonomicon, Diamond Age, the three-volume Baroque cycle, Anathem.
I like to go with other people's pronunciations. I don't necessarily insist on one right way of doing it.
Also, there are a couple of thrillers co-authored with J. Frederick George by Stephen Berry.
Stephen Berry was the combined pen name that we used when we did those collaborations, and then later we broke it out into the two separate names.
Neal Stephenson has also written several essays on technology, and I guess you'd call it futurism, which we'll probably talk a little bit about. But let's start with Reamed, a 1,000-page action thriller tied to a world gaming community. And that brings up a number of questions. And the first one is the relationship of the land of Terrain, T-R-A-I-N, with World of Warcraft, as well as something called the Mongoliad.
The sort of deep background of this is that it all kind of comes out of Dungeons & Dragons, ultimately, which is a pencil and paper game that I used to play a little bit when I was in college 30-some years ago, and it was fairly old then. As soon as computers started becoming available, people began moving those games over onto computers in the form of simple text-based adventures, and as the internet came along, they became multiplayer games, and as graphics got better, they jumped out of the level of pure text and became three-dimensional immersive environments that you could kind of virtually move around in. At the moment, World of Warcraft is a particularly well-known example of such a game, but there's others as well. And what we're seeing here in the fictitious game of Terrain is kind of my half-baked idea of what a next generation one of these might look like a few years in the future.
And how does the Mongoliad fit into that?
It doesn't.
At all?
No. The Mongoliad is a collaborative, serialized online novel that is being co-written by me and six other writers that's been coming out in weekly installments for a little bit over a year now, and we plan to have it all wrapped up in another few weeks, after which we'll probably go on to kind of season two, as we're calling it, the sequel. It's a straight novel. It's kind of a throwback to the 19th century serialized novels that used to come out in, you know, the Strand magazine and its ilk on a weekly or monthly basis. And we're just kind of doing it with a high-tech twist. But it's not a game as such. It's not, so far anyway, it doesn't really have playable content.
But it could down the road.
We'd like it to.
Yeah. So in essence, you could be creating the world that would become a Terrain if you chose to go that path.
Yeah, different subject matter.
It's 1300s history, yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of Reamed, the basic pattern is that there's a virus created called Reamed that's introduced into Terrain, and that starts the plot rolling. To go back to that, after you finished Anathem and you were looking around, what brought you to the idea of at least beginning a thriller with an online game?
The way that these things seem to work is that I'll get ideas that will rattle around in my head for a number of years before I actually sit down and start working on them. So Anathem, for example, the idea came to me in late 1999. I didn't start work on it until 4 or 5 years later. In this case, the kernel of the idea for Reamed had come to me even earlier than that, I think. In the 90s, there was a series of events in which some kid in Manila or China or some other country had created a virus and sort of unleashed it on the internet, and it would spread across the whole world in a matter of hours or days and wreak a lot of havoc. I found something fascinating in those stories. It hasn't happened as often recently because I think that virus writing has become more of an organized enterprise, but there was a kind of Wild West era when these things would come out of nowhere and end up being traced back to just some kid. And I liked that as the basis for a story, just because of the sort of imbalance of power that's going on there. I had the idea quite a while ago of writing a book in which some kid did that, and the virus ended up seriously inconveniencing a powerful person who decided to come after that kid and track them down and get revenge.
Now, going back to terrain, we see a lot of terrain from the point of view of many of the characters. From your point of view, Neal Stephenson, how detailed is it, or are we pretty much seeing everything there is in the book?
How detailed is the game world? You're seeing pretty much everything there. I guess as I've gone along in my career, I've become a bit more conservative about generating huge amounts of material that aren't going to make it into the book. Because obviously, as you can see just from eyeballing this volume, my tendency is toward writing long stuff and including a lot of detail. In general, it's easier to write stuff to length and keep it that way than to put in a ton of stuff that you need to go in later and rip out. 20 years ago, if I'd been writing this book, I probably would have planned out everything about this world, this fictional world, in a ridiculous level of detail and ended up with a bunch of stuff that I couldn't use or that I'd have to edit out of the text later. In this case, I really just created what I needed.
And then if there were any inconsistencies, went back and fixed it.
Yeah.
A lot of the action takes place in Amoy. Shaman? I don't know how to...
The old school name for it was Amoy. So if you read older books, that's what it's called. And it's been called Shaman, X-I-A-M-E-N, for, I think, ever since the 40s, I would assume.
Did you go there?
Yeah.
And how much time did you spend there?
A few days. It's the same situation again, where when I go to a new place, I see a lot. The senses are very acute when you're in an unfamiliar place. And I tend to take in a lot of information pretty fast, as most people do. And I see 90% of everything I'm going to see probably in the first day or two. And to hang around for a long time and collect a huge amount of material is sort of tempting from a certain point of view. But again, it leads to a lot of stuff that can't be used or that has to be ripped out later.
Why there? I mean, did you start with, I'm going to send my people to a place where they'll have easy access to escape, or did you start with a visit to Shaman?
It was a completely random thing. You know, I've read that there's a huge number of cities in China that have over 1 million people in them, many of which most people here have never heard of. I didn't want it to be Beijing or Shanghai. As it happened, I had a friend who was going to Shaman to do research for a book of his own, and he had a local sort of guide and translator who could kind of show him around. And I decided to just tag along. So the choice of that city was originally just sort of random luck that I happened to know somebody who was going there. And as it turned out, it was a much more interesting and appropriate city for my purposes as a thriller writer than I ever could have anticipated.
Because it's right on the water, it's right near another country,
yeah.
And you could put people in a rowboat and they could escape.
Yeah, this was a complete, sort of welcome surprise, is that when I was a kid, we heard all the time about these two islands named Quemoy and Matsu. The only thing we really knew about them was that they were getting shelled by China all the time. Occasionally, there would be a little diplomatic flare-up about these. You always heard Nixon and so on talking about Quemoy and Matsu. Well, those islands are situated in the harbor of Xiamen. They're controlled by Taiwan, and they've been a sore point between Taiwan and People's Republic of China for that long. And you can indeed, in a rowboat or even by swimming, cross that border and get between those two countries.
The border crossing idea follows through in Rimdi a lot, the nature of security today. A lot of the action happens in northern Idaho and southern British Columbia. Near a town named Elphinstone in British Columbia, which about halfway through the book I checked and found out that there is an Elphinstone.
In Manitoba.
Yeah, you moved it about 1,000 miles.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a case where I hadn't made up my mind what the town was going to be called. I wanted it to be named after some old Victorian British guy because that's how a lot of stuff gets named up there. I stumbled across Elphinstone and thought it was an appropriate name. Then to my chagrin, I found that there was already an Elphinstone in Manitoba, and then I came to my senses and remembered that I was a fiction writer and I'm allowed to make things up. If you have been reading this book with Google on your lap, there's actually a little disclaimer in the back in the acknowledgments. Maybe I should have put it in the front, kind of warning people against trying to follow the action too closely on Google Maps. And it's, you know, you've put your finger on a really interesting feature of sort of the modern, you know, literary ecosystem, which is that anyone who's writing a work of fiction that has any geographical references at all can have their work, as it were, kind of cross-checked by the reader, who can try to follow what's going on in Google Maps or on Street View or whatever. It creates a whole new set of challenges for both the writer and the reader that we're still kind of working out how to address.
You have a number of characters. One character, Richard Forthrast, who is the entrepreneur behind Terrain, he's pretty understandable. But the other main character is Zula, his niece, who's from Eritrea. And she came over as, I think, a 12-year-old, and now she's in her 20s. And she plays a major role in this. Reverse engineering, when realizing that somewhere terrorists were going to play a role, is that when you decided to have her from Eritrea, or did that come first?
No, it came first. There's nothing at all kind of remarkable or unusual about finding adopted kids, especially from that part of the world, you know, sort of all over the country now, including the upper Midwest, which is where she was raised. So she came over when she was, I think, more like 6 or 7, and was raised on the family farm in Iowa ever since then. So she has memories of where she came from, and they sort of come to the surface from time to time during the story. But, you know, they're kind of memories as little kids have memories, you know, the kind of dreamlike quality that we all have.
Can we see some kind of parallels between the fictional world of Forthrast, his world, and the world that he created?
He grew up on this farm in Iowa, which, you know, is a big, flat, open piece of land that in a lot of ways it doesn't have scenic beauty. It's not exceptional in any way, but it's home. It's where he grew up. And he understands that he's not going to inherit that farm. And so he goes out in search of real estate that he can make his. And he finds some beautiful physical real estate in the world that that he does end up owning, and it's spectacular. It has running mountain streams, and you can ski and hike and everything else, but it's always, for him, a place of exile. It's not the place where he grew up. And so growing out of that obsession with real estate is this game that he has created, which is set in an entire fictitious world, computer-generated world with landforms and continents and oceans and rivers and so on.
So it's still creating that same world, only within the world.
Yeah.
But things that you kind of pulled out of a hat at one point wind up having a serendipitous relationship with the end of the book. Is this common for you then?
I think it's common in the real world. I think there's all kinds of strange coincidences and unlikely reversals of fortune that happen to people all the time in the real world. And our instinct as authors is to shy away from that because we're always a little bit afraid that someone's going to say, hey, wait a second, that's too much of a coincidence, that's too improbable, you need to be more realistic. So paradoxically, you know, if you listen to those voices too much, you can end up creating characters and writing storylines that kind of are so logical and reasonable that they ring false in a certain way. They don't have some of the chaos and weirdness that real human stories have in this world. So it's a pretty fine kind of calibration that you have to make in trying to decide what level of happenstance and coincidence is best in a work of fiction.
In writing this, what kind of outline did you have? Did you just start and see where it went, other than knowing that they'd all come together at the end?
My approach to that is to try to keep it in my head as much as I can, because the outline is something that classically you would put together in the first few days of the project. And then once it's written down, it acquires a kind of permanence that it doesn't necessarily deserve, because you're going to work on the book for 2 or 3 years, and if things are going right, hopefully you're coming up with new ideas every day that can improve that outline. If you kind of respect that initial outline too much, and it means that you're not listening to those voices, you're not taking advantage of the new ideas that come in. One trick for avoiding that problem is to try to keep the outline, to the extent there is one, in the head, and then it kind of morphs over time almost beyond recognition. I just think it's a more fluid and natural way of proceeding.
And it also seemed as if some of the characters who came in after Zula and Forthrast, Sokolov, Olivia, Marlin, Changor, Yusha, the other primary characters in the book, mm-hmm. it seemed that some, if not all of them, kind of come in and then force themselves to stay in the book. Is that kind of how you felt?
I always knew that they were going to be with us all the way through. I had ideas of, say, in the case of Changor, I knew that there would be a sort of hacker with a kind of ambiguous past from Eastern Europe who would get sucked into this thing, and that we would see him go through some changes over the course of the story. I think that's what makes for an interesting story, or can make for an interesting story, is see people who maybe are not what they initially seemed they were, to see them change over time in response to circumstances. So, yeah, that was always the plan in his case.
Were there any plans that went awry?
I'm going to give you an answer that might sound a little self-regarding, and I'll try to explain it. Basically, the answer is no, but that's not because I'm such a great planner. It's because I try to avoid planning too much. Is kind of for the reason that I mentioned earlier, which is that the ideas that come to one during the actual writing of the book need to be taken seriously and need to be folded into that story as you go, and particularly when your characters do things you didn't expect for them to do. That's commonly a sign that something interesting is going on creatively, and that's got to be respected. It's got to be folded in. Doing that is kind of antithetical to having some kind of great big plan.
You do have a character, a spy named Seamus, kind of make an appearance well past the halfway point. And I was wondering if he was there from the start, if you intended to bring him in, if you realized you needed him. How did that work?
He was always in there because it has to do with the past story of one of the other characters, one of the bad guys. I always knew that there would be that person in his past who would sort of emerge a little bit later and want to get involved in the story. And again, this is another one of these questions of how do you achieve the right amount of verisimilitude in a story? Because in real stories, in the things that happen to us in real life, people do come in late. Right, it's not like we always start with a set of people and follow them all the way through in real life. People will show up at the last minute and suddenly become important in our lives or in something that we're doing. So even though it can seem a little bit strange to suddenly bring in a new major character late, I just felt, I hoped that it would ring true.
And the last third of the book deals with a series of chase sequences. And you always knew that was going to be in there, I guess.
Yeah.
Did you go wandering through the mountains of northern Idaho?
I'm somewhat familiar with the territory. And, again, it's kind of like the question about Shaman. I have to watch myself. You know, I could so easily see going up there with a backpack and coming out a month later with 10,000 pages of notes, and then wanting to cram in, you know, detailed descriptions of wildflowers and rock formations and rotten logs into the story. that might be good as a kind of writerly self-gratification, but wouldn't do anything for the reader. So, again, it's a matter of getting enough without getting an excessive amount.
How did you come up with Rheem-D?
Well, the story is that this virus is an example of something called ransomware, which is a real category of viruses in cyberspace today. And the way ransomware works is that once the virus has gotten control over your computer, it'll simply take every single file on your hard drive and encrypt it using strong encryption technology that is practically impossible to break. But obviously it won't tell you the key that you need to decrypt the file. And so in order to get that key, you've got to pay some kind of ransom to somebody. So the way this one works in the book is that if this thing infects your system, 1 minute it'll be normal, the next minute you look at it and there's only two files on the whole system. One is a gigantic file that contains all of your encrypted data, and the other one is just a little README file that contains, it's the ransom note. In the story of the book, the kid who was creating it just got excited and typed too fast, and it came out as as Rheem-D.
Neil Stephenson, let's go back to your career. Did you always want to be a writer? Did you read a lot of science fiction as a kid?
Yes to both. I started thinking about trying to be a writer pretty early. I mean, I very clearly remember that in fifth grade, my best friend showed up for school one day wearing leather shoes as opposed to sneakers. And leather shoes, for me, had always been instruments of torture. And so I found that very disturbing. I saw it as the beginning of a trend that was going to lead in a few years to all of us having to dress that way all the time and not being able to run around. And so at that point, I began looking for an escape route. And I thought that being a writer might serve that purpose. So I tried to write a couple of short stories when I was probably, I don't know, sixth, seventh grade. They didn't work out. I was only trying to do what they always tell you to do, which is start with short stuff and work your way up. I now see that as bad advice because some people aren't really cut out to write short stuff, and I'm obviously one of them. So I was able later to sit down and write a whole novel, but I've never really written a short story. The few things I've had published as short stories really read like the first chapter of a novel.
Were you blown away by Neuromancer? Was that a key to you?
It was a key to me. I read a lot of science fiction up through, some point in, say, college, and then sort of didn't read it for a long time. This would have been the late 70s, early 80s. So I went for a number of years not reading it at all. Then I think Neuromancer was 84. I saw an article about it, I think, in Rolling Stone, and picked it up and read it, and I was just amazed that someone had done this, which is written a book that was a great science fiction book that was also a serious work of literature, and that was fun to read. It was an exciting, thrilling read about new kinds of technology, not just, rocket ships and ray guns, but cyberspace. So the effect of that book was to kind of make me aware that you could get away with doing that. In one sense, I've tended to be pretty cautious, at least to that point, tended to accept the existing limits on, sort of what you couldn't get away with in the field of writing, and I just never thought that you could do something like Neuromancer.
Well, you hadn't stumbled across Chip Delaney at that point, or had you? I mean, something like Dahlgren?
No, I hadn't read Dahlgren. So, I think it's a random thing. It just depends on who you bump into first. But that woke me up and got me thinking about trying to write some, sort of go back to science fiction, which I'd been away from for quite a while, and try to see what I could do in that sphere.
Is that when you came up with that first novel that's mostly vanished, or was that when you came up with Snow Crash?
Well, let me think about it for a second. If I'm right that Neuromancer was 84, I probably read it when it had been out for a year or two. The next book I wrote after that was Zodiac, the environmentalist kind of eco-thriller, which wasn't really influenced, I would say, by Neuromancer. But then the next book after Zodiac was Snow Crash.
Which was?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then after that came Diamond Age. Now, by that point, steampunk had already made a mark. I think there was a collaboration, Difference Engine.
The Difference Engine, yeah. Yeah, had been out for a couple of years, I want to say.
And you had read that by then?
Yeah. Yeah. So I read it as soon as it came out, yeah.
So you knew that there was an entire new field that you could start exploring.
I'm not sure when the term steampunk was coined. That would be an interesting thing to go and look into. I think there are a lot of people who've got kind of a soft spot for Victoriana and are always looking for excuses to write something in that kind of a setting. And so I had harbored those kinds of thoughts for a while and had worked on some unfinished stuff that I think could be viewed as sort of proto-steampunk work. And then, again, when Difference Engine came out, it was like, oh, look, there's other people who want to do this kind of thing, too. I'm not alone.
Well, then after that, Neal Stephenson, you broke out with Cryptonomicon, which is not science fiction, though it might have futurist elements in it, and is also a thriller, which set you on a completely new path. How did that come about?
There was a moment, I think, after The Diamond Age was published when I paid a visit down to the Bay Area and bumped into some friends of mine who were techies. I had seen them a few months earlier, and they had all been working on various projects. And then I came down a few months later, and suddenly they were all talking about money, sort of cryptographic techniques for doing secure financial transactions and e-currencies and that kind of thing. And that's because e-commerce was just taking off, and those kinds of technologies were sorely needed. But I thought it was interesting that just all of a sudden, or so it seemed to me, all the smart techies were suddenly alive to this, were thinking about it. That got me kind of vaguely thinking about a book that would address those topics. I originally had an idea for a kind of three-part book that would have one thread set in World War II, another in the contemporary world, and another in the future. So I started working on all of those. The way it sort of developed was that the future thread had a few promising aspects, but it wasn't really coming together. But the other two were coming together, I thought, pretty nicely, and the interplay between the two stories, I thought, was going to work better for the reader than trying to jump around among three stories. So after a lot of kind of false starts and experimentation, I settled on the structure for Cryptonomicon that we ended up with, which is essentially it's two books, one in World War II, one in the contemporary world. Each of those books by itself is kind of a normal length novel, but their chapters are kind of interleaved with each other throughout the volume, and the stories kind of play off against each other.
Are you familiar with a play called Arcadia by Tom Stoppard?
I haven't read it.
You haven't seen it? Takes two different and does the same thing.
Yeah, but I know I've had this conversation before, so I guess I really need to go and check it out.
And then you came up with The Baroque Cycle, which is historical fiction, three long volumes of historical fiction, which put you in a completely different path as well. What was the feedback from all of your science fiction fans to that?
Well, I would say that most of them were happy to go there. I certainly got a few very unhappy people, but they were in a distinct minority. The themes of The Baroque Cycle are directly related to those in Cryptonomicon. The way that I got onto that project was essentially by following those threads backwards in time for a couple of hundred years. Readers of science fiction and fantasy, they are people who like to be taken to other worlds. Going into a historical world can be just as satisfying to that urge as going into a future science fiction world or a fantasy.
Years ago, someone reminded me that James Clavell's Shogun is nothing more or less than a First Contact novel.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, great analogy. You know, when I was a kid reading these big anthologies of science fiction stories, every so often in the middle of one of these anthologies, there would be a historical story, typically just dropped in there with no comment. You know, it was just unremarkable. And in general, if you scratch a geek or a science fiction nut, you will find somebody who has read deeply in history and knows a lot about at least one area of world history.
You'd have to do a great deal more research for the Baroque Cycle than for something like Anathem, even a thriller like Rheem-D,
yeah,
simply because there's so much that you have to get right.
Yeah, that was a very research-intensive project. And so for the first, I would say, 4 months, I really didn't do anything except read. And then it got to the point where I was maybe reading 80% of the time and writing 20% of the time. And by the time I was done, it was flipped the other way. So I really only had to go to the books if I needed to pin down some terribly specific detail.
And then we have the return to science fiction, Anathem, and then Rimdi, which is a contemporary thriller. Was there any relationship in terms of writing Rimdi to those Stephen Barry books?
I would say a kind of indirect relationship in that I really dug writing those things. It's a really nice change of pace from, say, a historical book, which does require so much research, or a science fiction book in which you have to imagine all of the details, the kind of tactile and visual details of a future, to just sit down and write a book that is set in the world that we live in, where you can just describe things. You can say, you know, they drove in a car to the building, you know, instead of they got in the hyperflipper, you know, and glided to the, you know, the rotating torus. You know, it's just a nice change of pace. I enjoyed writing those earlier thriller-type books a lot. I imagine, you know, knock on wood, if the career goes on, I'll probably keep returning to this type of book every so often just because I enjoy it.
Neal Stephenson, you've also written a great deal on technology. There's an article recently published in World Policy Institute online called Innovation Starvation, in which you talk about the reasons why you think innovation has slowed down. And it seems to me that the main reason is that people are afraid to take chances. I mean, that's one.
Yeah.
I mean, you also
yeah.
talk about the death of science fiction, which I have my own theories about.
Yeah. I can start, I think, on pretty firm ground. And then as I work my way out, I get on shakier and shakier footing in a certain way. So it's pretty clear that if you look at the first two-thirds of the 20th century, you know, at the beginning, we don't have airplanes. At the end of that period of time, we're walking on the moon. At the beginning, we don't have cars. By the end, we've got freeways all over the country and cities built around the use of the car. Could use up the rest of the hour just citing examples of all of the huge innovations that took place during the first two-thirds of the 20th century. Since then, we've got the Internet. That's an amazing thing. But other than that, it's hard to point to any big innovations. And so the question then poses itself as to why that is. And I think that's a fascinating discussion. I've already heard a lot of different ideas on it that are worth considering. My role, the one thing I can definitely do in all of this is to write science fiction. And so I do feel I'm on reasonably firm ground in trying to generate some science fiction that's going to be, I guess, kind of a throwback to the techno-optimistic stuff of the Golden Age, and maybe a turn away from the kind of gloomy, sort of inward-looking science fiction that people like me, I'm Exhibit A, have been writing for the last couple of decades.
It seems to me that one issue, which you don't discuss there, which concerns the nature of science fiction itself, if innovation came out of the imagination of science fiction writers, let us say, and then people actually took some of those ideas and began thinking about them, and then 15 or 20 or 25 steps down the road began innovating, physically innovating, then I wonder, since the advent of Star Wars and the death of the genre as an adult field and the incorporation of people like Neal Stephenson into the mainstream, which is pretty much what has happened, it's become so diffuse that people can't really go to a place anymore and say, okay, this is what I'm going to read.
Yeah, it's become a collection of sub-genres and kind of sub-sub-sub-genres that really have very little in common with each other except the name.
And also, it's been relegated to the 15-year-old, you know, volume 15 of you know, the Bulduki cycle, you know.
Ah, the Bulduki cycle. Yeah, one of my favorites. I think what science fiction can do is present an innovation in a plausible, kind of coherent social context. So it's one thing to say that we should have a jetpack, just to name a totally random example. it's a different thing to write a story set in a world where everybody flies around in jetpacks. And that, I think, can help the innovator in kind of selling the idea. So the tricorder in Star Trek is this tablet that people carried around and used to get sensor data of various kinds. And nothing would prevent you from trying to sell that idea to a venture capitalist, but you'd have to kind of give this tedious explanation of what it was good for, which might not stand up to scrutiny. But if you can point to a Star Trek episode and say, look, that's how it would be used, then suddenly that picture is there and it can guide the thinking of the design team. It can sort of answer a lot of questions in the minds of the engineers and kind of help organize their efforts.
It seemed to me that in reading your piece, though, that when you were talking about how things have become dystopia, people are focusing on dystopia rather than forward-looking, part of that has to do with, obviously, the global depression, and I'm talking psychological depression.
Mm-hmm.
It also has to do with a certain amount of blowback for the technology of those past years. I mean, what has been the result of the cars and the airplanes, but, you know, global climate change?
Yeah. The way it looks to me is that technology kind of developed to a certain point where we figured it was good enough, and then it kind of stopped. So, you know, we got to the point where we could drive around in cars about as fast as we're willing to drive. And then we just said, okay, fine, we're good. We'll drive around in cars forever. There hasn't been an effort to kind of move beyond that way of thinking and come up with something better than the car. We're stuck with a bunch of 1960s technology, basically.
But it's also true that the powers that be, the money game, is on old technology and is on oil, is on old energy, and they've been working overtime, lying and cheating, to keep people from thinking that there are other options and to block options.
A big part of what happens in these situations where we're kind of stuck is that it's not just that there aren't any good technical ideas, because there are plenty. It's sort of about mustering the will in the organization to actually make the changes. And there tends to be an incredibly powerful combination of sort of legal, financial, regulatory, even insurance issues that make it really hard to effect fundamental changes. So even in things like rocket launch, there's all kinds of non-rocket technologies that have been proposed for launching things into space. Well, that's really nice, but the problem is that satellites are expensive, and they have to be insured. And an insurance company is perfectly willing to insure a launch on an old sort of, you know, 60s-era platform because they have numbers on it. They know the odds it's going to fail. If you invent something new, it might be way better than that, but you're not going to get any customers because you can't insure the launch. So all of those factors interlock in a way that really gets in the way of changing things.
But when you're talking about the things getting in the way of changing things, those things existed in the 70s. Is it just because government took a more active role then?
Well, in that one particular case, I think so.
Yeah.
Certainly the rocket launch industry, you know, is clearly a government product. Other than that, I guess you'd have to look at it on a case-by-case basis.
The forces of people like the Koch brothers bringing money to bear and propaganda to bear to say there is no climate change, to say we can't innovate. An event like Solyndra could kill solar energy when it's just a singular event. And you've got people out there whose fortunes depend on keeping innovation from happening, it seems to me.
Energy is an interesting case because so much of our system for delivering it to the user is organized around the idea of petrochemical fuels. And to replace that with something based on electricity or other sources of power ends up requiring a huge tear out of existing infrastructure and building a whole lot of new stuff. And that's really expensive, whereas sort of, you know, if you move the cost of gasoline up by, you know, another nickel a gallon, suddenly you're generating a vast amount of marginal money that makes the efforts of the alternative fuel people seem kind of foolish. The deck is certainly stacked in that sense against people who want to make fundamental change in how we move energy around.
I think we're moving to a point where you have an immovable object and a movable situation pushing against that. And we see signs of it, little signs of it, in the unrest in America and certainly unrest around the world. I mean, maybe we're moving to an 1848 situation in terms not only of technology but people.
Well, it's been an interesting feature of the political landscape here that, you know, people who in other countries would be communists are not. They won't go down that road. People who want to see the existing power structure changed tend to come at it from odd angles, or at least they look like odd angles if you're accustomed to viewing things from a classical kind of lefty-righty sort of perspective. So a lot of the people who in any other country would be card-carrying, you know, socialists, or, you know, be marching in demonstrations are listening to Rush Limbaugh. And I'm not the first person to observe this. There's, you know, books written about it, like What's the Matter with Kansas and so on. I find that very interesting, and it makes me wonder sort of what kinds of changes those people are going to end up advocating. Is there going to be a swing back towards a more conventional left-right sort of dynamic in this country, or are we going to see something that we haven't seen before? Are the protests on Wall Street the beginning of that? I don't know. I'm certainly staying tuned.
Neil Stephenson, now you've completed and published ReamD. You working on something else?
Not exactly yet. I have an idea for a contribution I want to make to the Hieroglyph anthology about innovation. I've got a couple of ideas for what the next novel might be, but I haven't picked a leading contender yet.
And Snow Crash is on its way to becoming a movie?
Well, that's been under discussion for going on 20 years. Sometimes it picks up steam. Sometimes it slows down a little bit. So anything I could say about it now would probably be wrong by the time this thing hits the air.
You've been listening to an interview with Neil Stephenson, whose latest novel is ReamD. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.